coming on the air here with a special broadcast this evening that involves a long-distance interview with Jeremy and Molly Hale in Palo Alto, California, and Jim Beck here.
Menlo Park.
Oh, that's right. Menlo Park.
We're actually literally on the border.
I think we're both right. Well, Lee Hendrickson and I, Mike Malevsky, are here in the studio with Jim Beck, who's executive director at Access Alaska. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Mike. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
And Molly and Jeremy, you're associated with your own organization down there. Would you tell us what that is?
So, Ability Production. We are a nonprofit that Molly and I founded in 2004 to basically share the journey that we've been on for the last 18 years of Molly coming back and rehabilitating herself from a severe spinal cord injury, and she was told that she would never have any voluntary movement from the top of her shoulders down. And because she had so much physical body-related information at the time that she had this injury, she basically used all this information to see if she could go beyond that prognosis. And she's had unusual success with warm water therapy, equine therapy, riding horses, breath practices, using balls of all sizes to access mobility in her body. And so we founded Ability Production so that we could share that information with everybody out there who would benefit by it for free. So that's pretty much what we do. We create content and short films, and are creating a video archive library on our website so that everybody can get access to it and get this information. So,
and that's the short story, but how we get involved in the whole accessible design is because of our own need, and my background is as an architectural designer.
Well, what we're going to focus on today, and it's good that you gave that intro, and from in a moment we'll have Jim talk a little bit about the role that Access Alaska plays here. We could do many shows, and I see a further show in our collective future. But today, what I'm wanting to do is focus on what we have suggested we would do, and that is the topic of universal design. So before we plunge into that, Jim, do you want to say a bit about Access Alaska and your role there?
I'd be happy to. Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I'm, as Mike said, the executive director at Access Alaska, and we are a federally recognized center for independent living. There's independent living centers throughout the United States. There's four in Alaska. One of the, I think, really interesting and cool things about Centers for Independent Living is we are what they call consumer controlled, which means the feds actually require us to have the majority of our staff experience a disability, and the majority of our board of directors has to actually experience a significant disability, finger quotes around significant. So what the feds were trying to do when they came up with this was to recognize that independent living was an outgrowth of the disability rights movement, which was part of the civil rights movement in some ways. And as any social change movement does, it came from the people. So the feds tried to take a social movement and turn it into a federally funded disability program. So that's sort of where Centers for Independent Living come from. So our job in communities is to not only help people who have disabilities to access their dreams of living more independently, but also to make our communities more accessible to folks with disabilities. So hopefully improving the world as we go along, not just helping people one at a time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jim. Lee, do you have any comments you'd like to make here before we plunge into the specifics of universal design?
Well, I see a nice tie-in with what Jim was talking about, making our communities and places more accessible, and universal design is a way to conceptualize buildings and spaces so that they are accessible to people of all differing abilities.
Okay.
So nice.
Now, Molly or Jeremy, we have had the good fortune to have visited you over many years. And so we are aware of what you have done within your own personal environment at home. Do you want to kick off with a discussion of perhaps what you see this whole concept of universal design to be?
Well, I can say a few words, and we're, Jeremy and I are pretty good at, you know, like batting this back and forth. One of the things that I noticed about universal design is that it has sprung out of the need for access for people with mobility issues. But what is actually happening with it is that universal design is just what it says. It is it expands an inclusivity that supports everyone, able-bodied people, short people, tall people, everybody in the middle, people on wheels, whether it's a bicycle or a stroller or a wheelchair or a skateboard, in terms of the outside environment, it just makes access for everyone easier. And it started from this intent of the disability community, and it's rolling out to be important for everybody.
Yeah, I think of what the my definition for universal design. I mean, you can find all kinds of stuff on the internet about it, but probably in a nutshell, when I think of universal design, it's design that makes things safer and easier and more convenient for everyone. And I think that it's a way of thinking. It's actually very very functional, and it's not complicated at all. I think once somebody begins to think in this way, it's really easy to look around and go, oh yeah, this makes so much sense. It's very intuitive. And in fact, that changes that get made when universal design gets applied, it actually makes things easier for people who are differently abled. But it also makes things easier for people who don't have any issues at all. They're perfectly healthy, and they have good hands and feet and legs. But universal design makes things easier for them as well. So it really is inclusive of young and old and all different abilities, and that's kind of how I think about it.
Okay. Jim, we've had conversations up here before, and I've seen your eyes light up and you're smiling nodding your head affirmatively as Jeremy and Molly describe their sense of universal design. How would you approach the same question?
Well, I've enjoyed every minute of the last few minutes, and I was smiling, thinking of maybe the first time that some poor little municipality somewhere busted up and put in a bunch of curb ramps on the corners, and the next thing they know, somebody pushed a baby in a stroller across that curb ramp, and hopefully the designers were standing there and thought, oh, look how convenient that was for that person. We built this for those wheelchair people, but look, there's somebody who doesn't even have a disability taking their baby right across that curb ramp. But it's just such a good basic example of just good design. Those falling off a curb has never been very convenient for anybody if you think about it.
That's true. That's true. Now, I know, Molly and Jeremy, that you have taken this concept and your interest in it. Over the years, I want to swing back to your house. What have you done in your house over the years that has made it more convenient from a universal design standpoint?
Well, fortunately, because I've been designing, as my mother would say, since I was a tiny child, when I brought my design skills to this house long before I was injured, I had a sensibility about space So when I broke my neck and the wheelchair became my extension of my mobility, what we had to do was mitigate the step at the front door and at the back door. And that was pretty simple because we're, you know, about 8 inches above grade. So we put ramps at our front door and at our back door to make it simple to get in and out. And onto the deck, and those are just, you know, logistically, so how do you get in and out of the space? And then we installed handrails in the bathrooms, and those have come in handy not just for me, but again for my now 93-year-old mother. Children kind of like to swing on them if they have the opportunity. In the bathrooms where I want to roll up to the sink, we did some very simple things. We just simply took off the doors that impeded my ability to be able to get close to the sink, and we did the same thing in the kitchen.
Right, that's the doors on the cabinets underneath.
On the cabinets, yeah, not the bathroom door itself.
Right. Just remembering your house.
Yeah. And also in the kitchen, we already had shelving in the base cabinets that rolled out, but they only rolled out halfway. So we removed the doors on the cabinetry in the kitchen and then put full extension guides on the roll-out drawer. So now they roll out completely. And this allowed, you know, pretty easy access. Those things that required a standing person, like our plates and dishes and all those things were up high, those all got moved down to the lower cabinets. And what we found was when that made it so much more convenient for me, but in redoing my mother's kitchen, we did the same thing for her. And this is kind of a trend that is taking off in the kitchen design as it is that people are starting to put things lower and they're letting go of a lot of the upper cabinetry. What else did we do? Well, for me specifically, because my physicality requires a lot of exercise and things, and I would do a lot of that on the floor, but now I'm on the floor, and how do I get from the floor back into the chair or into, basically back into the chair? And it was, you know, power lifting myself off the floor. So in the end of our living room, we built a 12-foot long by 6-foot deep platform that's 20 inches tall. And over that, we put a tumbling mat and pulled up a carpet that goes up and over the top of this platform, and then we covered it in sheepskin because sheepskin is the ideal thing to keep the skin healthy for someone who's not particularly mobile, and covered it with about 50 pillows. So this pod, as we call it, that's in the end of our living room, has become my raised floor, if you will, where I can do my yoga, my crawling, all my exercising, and I don't have to get myself off the floor. And what has happened is that when adults come to visit, they want one in their living room because it's like this lovely, comfortable place that you don't have to sit with your legs hanging over. So it's been a wonderful spot. My mother, again, I said she's 83, loves to sit on that and 93, pardon me, my mother's 93, likes to sit on that so she can get her feet up and stretch out. And again, tuck the pillows all around her and be in a comfort zone. So those are some of the things we've done. We were fortunate. Our doorways were wide enough. We already had lever handles on most of our doors, which made it, very simple. Jeremy, anything else that we've done?
Well, I think for the most part that covers a lot of things. We did not do a big remodel. What Molly has described has been, we built everything ourselves, but even if we would have had somebody do it, it would have been a small budget. We did not throw a bunch of money at it, and we did very practical, easy changes that anybody can do to their home to make it more just easier to use. And because we were living it every day, we very quickly realized what kinds of changes that we needed to make things easier for Molly. And we were, like I said, we were amazed at how intuitive it became very quickly and how simple it all was.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, you're once again nodding your head. I can share that with the listeners.
He's been taking notes and checking his list. Okay, he did that. He did that.
Yeah.
So, Jim, do you have any comments or additions here?
One of the things that's so fun about this for me is this is like cross-country peer support. And I neglected to mention that I was also spinal cord injured in a car accident in 1982. So I'm an L2-3 incomplete para. So I both ambulate with crutches and braces, but also use a wheelchair a lot around the house. And I'm just always so intrigued about the ways that we all invent to make our lives accessible. And I love you throw a group of people with disabilities into a room, and for one, we have a common culture, and so we're kind of instantly doing some peer support across the radio here, but always learning things, and I just love to see what other people do to cope. One of the things that really occurred to me during that little conversation there was how I think that when universal design is done right, it accounts for the aging process, and that is one of the things that sort of little toothpicks that I was poking at Mike when we did our last interview was, as I've dealt with an aging mother as well, I'm also 52, so I'm getting there myself, and I've had a spinal cord injury for 31 years. I've had both my shoulders rebuilt, so I've never really been the same for more than a couple years, I think. And so I think when one can really figure out how universal design works, then you're putting design into place that's going to last and last and last, and you're not going to have to continue to change it. I sure agree with just what's fun is just the logistics of where you put things in a room, whether they're high or low, how frequently you use them, just really such simple stuff that isn't as much about the built environment, but about more how you use the built environment. I've really grown to love really simple little things like the flat blade light switches rather than the little toggle switches. If I'm flying in my room in a wheelchair, my shoulders hurt and I want to hit that switch with a big target. I don't want to have to make a micro movement to hit it. And I can find a easier way to hit it that doesn't hurt my shoulders, which is nice. And I'm always amazed what we folks with disabilities will do to ourselves, too, because for the first many years of living at our home here north of Palmer, I lived upstairs, so scooted my butt up a circular staircase and then transferred off the floor into a wheelchair when I got to the top. And, I hate to admit, but I haven't been able to get off the floor into a wheelchair for some years now because of my shoulders. But just getting out of the second floor was an amazing victory. So we sort of built out, and it's wonderful to live on one floor. I love living in a big ranch house right now. other, dumb little stuff like a pocket door to avoid door swing where it works has been handy, that kind of thing.
I'm trying to figure out how to get a pocket door that is on some kind of controller, so the pocket door will actually, you push a button and the pocket door opens for those people that don't have any handedness, really. That's one of the things that's on my drawing board right now, is trying to figure that out for a client.
That would be like a miniaturization of electric gate hardware of some sort, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
And we recently moved our offices in Anchorage from a rented space into, we purchased what at the time was a neighborhood health center, so one of the federally funded community health centers. And we were fortunate enough to have the funding to sort of gut the place and do almost what we wanted with it, but certainly what we could afford. And one of the things that we really liked about the design is that we used what they call barn doors for all of the spaces. So there's no swinging doors in the whole place. But you get the cool visual that you don't get in a pocket door. And the guys at the contracting company were so pleased because we gave them a demonstration of the force that we wanted it to take to open the doors. And we wanted somebody with very, very limited arm strength to be able to open and close the doors. And they were so proud when they accomplished that, making that door hardware work so that you could just barely touch that door and it will slide all the way across the tracks. And so we never have doors swinging into any space. What we did find, though, is that people are always knocking the doors off the track because they're backing their wheelchairs into them.
Yeah.
There's always something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to do here, you've done a nice job of setting the stage for things. I'm going to do a little bit early bottom of the hour and say this is KVRF Sutton and K208BC Palmer, for those people who don't know. Radio Free Palmer coming to you from, in this case, a combination of Palmer, Alaska, and Menlo Park / Palo Alto, California. Well, Jeremy, Molly, Jim, now that we've set the stage, we've talked a little bit about universal design. I know I've had independent conversations, and we've talked about what does it take to have more people do preemptive universal design. Let me start down there with either Jeremy or Molly. What's your experience there?
Well, that's an interesting question, Mike. I remember when I went and got certified as an aging in place specialist with the National Association of Home Builders. One of the ways they talked about that was that universal design and accessibility, a lot of people, they don't think about that until a crisis happens. And when I think about the homes that we build in our country, for example, all the homes in the United States were all built for young, healthy people. And as you know, here we are, the biggest part of our population is now 50 years old and older, and for the next 30 years, that's also the fastest growing demographic of our population. There's never been a more dominant segment of our population in the history of our country than there is right now. And most people, when we ask them or they get asked, where do you want to live as you age, most everybody says, well, in my home, of course, as long as I can. Well, guess what? Because our homes were all built for young, healthy people, almost all of us have had experience already with somebody in our family, whether it's a loved one or a sister or a brother or a mom who has some kind of a physical ability issue and no longer can come and visit us in our homes because we have steps. They can't get up the steps. Mom had a hip replacement and whatnot, and so it's a huge issue that I see, that I feel like there's a tsunami that's offshore that's just building and building and building, and it's coming in, and still when I see a lot of new houses get built, even here in Silicon Valley, which is supposedly this cutting edge segment of the world and very forward-thinking, even in the Bay Area, where the ADA kind of started up here in Berkeley, houses get built They scraped a house two doors down from us. They scraped that house. They built a new house. They went out of their way to make steps up to the front door. And Molly and I both kind of scratched our heads and go, gosh, you know, it's just information, you know. It's like it's how do we move from 20th century thinking to the 21st century where things are changing. And I feel like, you know, people are slow to make these kinds of changes. The building industry has done things a certain way for so long, and it's hard to change. And so, you know, what has to happen for more people to become aware of universal design and all that kind of thing is I think that it's about education. It's about people like us continuing to have conversations and to let people know about it. You know, write blogs, get information out however we can, and, you know, to drive the change that is going to help everybody. You know, other than that, you know, I just think that it's going to be from crisis to crisis that's going to little by little change the way people think about space and space design. And eventually, I have no doubt that we're going to see big changes come. And yeah, I don't understand why anybody would ever build a home that isn't universally designed. We're not talking about a place that looks like a hospital or is industrial looking. It's actually when you walk into a home that is universally designed and done well, you don't know why, but everything works better. It doesn't look like a hospital or and the kind of products that are made now, I mean, they're so beautiful and well designed. It's just lovely, and it just makes everything easier to use. So I think it's just going to continue to grow, and the demand is going to be a lot of baby boomers who are now in that place where they want to stay in their homes, but yet they're realizing that they can't make community anymore because their homes aren't visitable because there's steps and there's doorways that aren't wide enough and there's handles that can't be used and somebody in a chair can't reach the light switch. There's, you know, any number of things that kind of are very, very simple to remedy, but people don't think about them until they have to.
Jim, do you want to tackle that same kind of question?
Yeah, and I just so appreciate what you just said, Jeremy. And the whole thing just it makes me crazy, I have to say. We call it the silver tsunami here in Alaska, where we actually have the fastest growing senior population in the United States. And here in our particular borough is the fastest growing senior population in the state of Alaska. So we've got a huge issue on our hands here in the state, but really we're reflective of the rest of the country, and Jeremy's absolutely right. I think this is a problem. We've got thousands upon hundreds of thousands of people coming at us who are going to survive disabilities that 50 years ago would have ended their life, and they're going to survive those disabilities with their high expectations for a decent quality of life intact. And I think it was Molly or maybe it was Jeremy who basically said, raise your hand if you want to spend your golden years in a nursing home, and everybody's sitting on their hands as quickly as they can. And, you know, I think at some point legal mandate is probably going to have to come to bear, and several states have experimented with visitability law. There's been a few half-hearted attempts in Congress to mandate some certain minimums that the private sector would build in single-family housing, but it's almost like there's a line there that the building industry is certainly not ready to go, and I'm not even sure if sort of society at large is ready to have mandates put upon it for how our private housing is built. But we're making a big mistake in this country, because it's going to turn out to be probably a horrific economic issue, as so much of this housing becomes inaccessible to people who need it, and we continue to build these units that are just going to turn over and over and over, and nobody is going to be allowed to age in so much of even the public housing stock, not to mention single-family dwellings.
So, Jim, I'm curious whether you have had some examples of a discussion with perhaps developers, I'm guessing you have, where there's been resistance. And, you know, I hear people being resistant because if they're going to do a more energy efficient or more universally designed place, it's going to cost too much up front. Do we have any sense, Jim, about what that cost too much actually means?
Well, I think it depends on how what the bottom line excess revenue over expenses that the developers are hoping to make out of any given project. And I know we're approached fairly consistently to sign on to projects because of the way a lot of the public housing gets built in most communities is that developers team up with nonprofit organizations so they can access tax credits and all sorts of ways to get these projects built. And some of the nonprofits are really, really good at getting housing done, which I have a great respect for. But they're less enthusiastic about doing something that crosses this line that I would argue is there that would have us, like Jeremy said, thinking in a new century as far as what our housing should look like and who should be allowed to live there. I've had conversations with developers who seem willing, but they're in it for the numbers, and if you can make the numbers work, I think they're pretty willing. There's so many levels of decision making as these projects get built. It's often that some of these very simple things get left behind. We've actually stopped signing letters of support and agreeing to memoranda of agreement without certain guarantees, and we want to see things like a bedroom on the first floor. We want to see backing in all shower stalls and so that grab bars can at least be added later. We'd love to see a no step entry. And these are things that would add, in most cases, less than 1% to the cost of any new construction. So just really, really simple stuff.
Mm-hmm. Molly, did you have a comment there?
I was just going to say it's somewhere between 1% and 3% because, you know, if you're putting in a doorway in a bedroom, you still have to frame the opening, and the cost of a door that is 3 feet wide versus the cost of a door that is 30 inches wide is minimal. You still have to do the framing. Everything's all there. So the cost increase are really minimal. And I find that one of the biggest blocks is in the architectural design field, that they're really just starting to address universal design in schools of architecture, which seems really strange for me. I mean, I've been addressing universal design since 1982, just because it made sense to me, you know. So the cost, it's interesting, they throw out the idea that it's going to cost so much more, which is not true. And what it actually does, it adds value to to the home.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, I have a little subtitle when I talk to people about universal design. I call it how to increase the value of your home. You know, because as this aging, you know, population is going to need housing that is more easily visitable, and how do we and we want to create communities. These are the kinds of changes that we want to make to our homes, and they're going to increase the value of that home.
Yeah. Recently, a friend who is wheelchair mobile was moving and selling her home, and she had all these features for her accessibility, really nice, like a zero entry coming in the front door and going out the back, and she had well-designed handrails, not the standard stainless steel industrial. And when they staged her home for sale, they removed everything, including the zero clearance entry. And you know, the house sold, of course. But by doing that, they eliminated a huge population of people who are out looking for homes to live in that they don't have to modify. So it's a real blind spot in the industry.
Okay. Yeah. I saw Lee look incredulous there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that... me too.
Right.
Yeah, but...
Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that's the nature of change. You know,
right.
you're talking about a huge industry. It does not change quickly. You're talking about people who have been doing things a certain way for a long time. They don't want to change, you know, and so even though change is going to come, and those kinds of changes take time to. For it to go on, but like Jim said, and we were talking about, you know, there's a tsunami coming, and that tsunami, when it crashes, is going to really things will change quicker and quicker as time goes on.
Right, yeah.
Lee.
I was just thinking, my job right now is I work with faculty who are teaching architectural engineering technology in the construction management program at UAA, There's a lot of talk about alternative energy and alternative building stuff and sustainability issues. It's like they're starting to talk about those things in the program, but I haven't heard anyone mention universal design. So
yeah.
And two of the faculty I work with are architects, although we don't have an architectural school in Alaska. You know, they just teach various parts of the construction management.
So I have a question here as I was listening to all of you speak, you have some connection with not only the local areas you live in, but the rest of the country, or perhaps even the rest of the world. Are there places that you would say, even out of the United States, or perhaps some state in the United States, that is a leader in the application of universal design principles? You know, I think perhaps of places like Scandinavia or somewhere. But Jim, you're saying yes.
What? I've always heard good things about Menlo Park.
Well, hey, it's true. I mean, this Bay Area, you know, there's been a lot of huge movement in this area for making things accessible. And one of the reasons why it's really good, I just have a little story to tell you. You know, they were doing curb cuts in our neighborhood, and they were, you know, merrily going about and marking up all the corners, and the corner on our block wasn't being marked. There already was a curb cut across the street. And so I was out there, and I was talking to the crew, and I was like, you know, well, how come we're not marking up this street? And it was, well, we're only taking care of those corners that are damaged in some way. And so I asked them if it would make a difference if I were to get out there with a sledgehammer and damage the corner. So the next day they were out there with their little orange spray paint, spray painting our corner. And when they...
they didn't want to see...
No, they would. And when they came to, you know, build their forms and do everything, at the bottom of the ramp, as it goes into the street, they were making this very carefully crafted 1.5-inch lip at the bottom of the ramp. And I said, and I told them, I said, you know, that is a barrier for anybody in a wheelchair, because if I'm coming across the street, I have to kind of stop, tip my wheelchair back to get over that 1.5 inches and then go up. And they just kind of stood there and scratched their head. And when they finished that ramp, it was nice. It had a smooth transition onto the street. And now all the rest of them are that way. Now this crew, and that's how they're building them. There's a certain blindness. I think everybody should spend a week in a wheelchair who's an architect or a builder and learn something about the lay of the land, because they don't get it unless they're taught.
That's right. Yeah, unless you walk in those shoes or roll in those wheels, you don't get it.
Yeah.
So we've talked with some specific examples, and they've I think identified universal design as a concept, and we've also pointed a little bit at what might be either socially, culturally, or just I don't know what way barriers to thinking about this. As I'm listening, I'm reminded of the fuel crisis back in the 70s, and that was that, you know, the movement toward the first wave toward fuel efficient vehicles came because the cost was so high. And I think there's a lot to be said by thinking about this growing proportion of the population, which is going to be in need of what we're talking about. But I'm wondering if you've had some examples of success that you can point to down there in Menlo Park or here that show. And I'm not saying that Molly, your success with that crew was not an important one. I'm thinking with a set of regulations, with some developers, that gives us some sense that there is movement to recognize the importance of universal design.
Well, one thing, the independent living center that was built in Berkeley and opened, it's called the Ed Roberts Campus, and that is an exemplary building. What they have done there is absolutely phenomenal because it is totally inclusive. They have a water feature in the building that helps people who are blind locate themselves in the space. They have a spiral ramp that goes from the first floor to the second floor in this huge sweeping curve that allows mobility on a ramp, and it's got the correct slope. Of course, they have elevators as well. The what's underfoot changes texturally. So again, someone who is blind can feel the variations under their feet. It's also varied in color for those people who have vision, but it's compromised. For me, it's like bathrooms. You know, I've been in so many different bathrooms in my life that you roll in and it's like, oh my gosh, how am I going to handle this? But they have done just an amazing job on all of their surfaces, their availability for easy movement. It's just stunning.
Okay. Jim, any examples that you come to your mind?
Well, the Ed Roberts campus, I've never been there, but it's Mecca for those of us in independent living. There's another center in Phoenix that's really similar, and it just, to me, what those examples show is what we're capable of when we put our mind to it. I think what happens is we're stuck thinking about visitability and universal design, at least as it applies to people with disabilities, as a disability issue. And I think as long as we keep thinking of it as a disability issue, it's going to be a sideliner. When really, to me, I think maybe I'm being a little melodramatic, but I really see this as it's going to be a national issue of economy, and I think we're going to get hit where it hurts at that point, and it won't be a disability issue anymore. It'll be an issue of national economic significance, if not national security. Waving my pen for emphasis at our host here.
Yes,
it's interesting that you said that, Jim, because I there's a difference in my mind between ADA and universal design.
Very much so.
ADA, yeah, and I think that's what you just described. Universal design is actually for everyone. The ADA is more for people with disabilities. And those measurements and design ideas are for people who are differently abled, or universal design includes people who are differently abled, but it includes everybody else as well. So it's not designing for a disability. It's just smart design is what it is.
Notice our examples were from the disability world, though.
Well, that's where it's coming from.
Right, right.
It's coming from that into the public sector, because so many of us, I mean, when I travel in the world, I always travel with my manual chair because, you know, one step, I'm not going anywhere in a power chair, you know. So my manual chair, I mean, I've been carried up four flights of steps, you know, stairs before to get to the fourth floor, all those kinds of things. This is like a huge, huge issue. But it seems to be rising out of the disability community and going into mainstream. And I think sometimes that might be where people get the resistance, because they're thinking, well, you know, nothing is ever going to happen to me. I'm not going to need, and I'm, you know, young and healthy, and why would I need to do these things?
I am
seeing more of a sensibility locally, mm-hmm. As there is a broadening of multi-generational living mm-hmm. in the same household. That seems to be driving some of the universal design principles entering into homes. Mm-hmm. I know that I've, you know, designed for people, and I was designing for them down the road, because one of the individuals has a life issue that's only going to be progressive. But right now, she's fine. Mm-hmm. So in the redesign of the kitchen and the bathroom spaces, I designed them in such a way that if she ever were to need a wheelchair for moving around, that one of the sinks in the bathroom, when you open the doors, there's nothing, it's just completely open underneath. And the doors slide in and back, so they're out of the way. And in that space, the other sink has a step that pulls out for the grandchildren. So the grandchildren can use the space when they're little tiny people and as they grow. And the shower space was created as a roll-in shower were it ever needed. So coming to it before anything occurs.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's good design.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Lee, you had a comment?
No, I'm just thinking, I can't remember the name of the song, but I remember a line from it that many of us are just temporarily able-bodied. So, an example for me, which is sort of a small scale thing, is our neighbor had a stroke. He was in all sorts of assistive living, and he's back home, and he works for the city of Palmer. He's can't right now, but his colleagues from the city came and built a ramp up to his house, totally remodeled his bathroom. You know, the house is now the main floor. He can't go downstairs anymore, but the main floor of the house is now totally accessible, you know, and it was mm-hmm. those guys doing it. And it makes me wonder, I mean, I almost want to chat those guys up a little bit and see how that has progressed. They're thinking about design issues, helping Bob be able to live in his house.
Right.
That's great. Great uh-huh. example.
Yeah. Well, folks, we've had not quite an hour. We're moving up toward the end time that we have available. This has been interesting to me as more of an observer listening to discuss universal design. Molly and Jeremy, any last comments?
He's pointing at me.
Oh, okay. That's Jeremy that must be.
Yes.
You handle this one. Again, I think, you know, the discussion is really important just in community at all. Doing anything to chat up contractors to chat up designers, interior designers, architectural designers, kind of like just getting in their face. Again, another brief story, a friend of ours was, you know, building a house that had a basement and two stories above, and I said, well, you know, here you're four adults living in this house, and you're all in your 50s. Could be one of these days one of you might need to be able to, you might not ambulate quite as easily. And has your architect provided any space in your home for elevators or an elevator, some way to get up and down? And, of course, she hadn't. And they brought this to her attention, and then they ended up stacking closets from the basement up through the first floor and up to the second floor. So if they ever needed that kind of a facility, that they had it available, the space was already there. Those kinds of creative content in design is really critical.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim?
Yeah.
Well, I think where we'll probably meet most success over time is going to be to continue to try to rise the issue as an economic issue. I'm going to be really interested to see what happens with our returning vets who come home young, many with disabilities. If you look back at the history of disability policy, where in our country modern disability services and a lot of policy really came out of World War I with the very few returning vets who survived with a disability. But over the years, we've sort of moved from this rehab charity model of disability policy where degreed professionals have to fix the broken person to where we are now, which is more of a socio-political model where we see that the locus of the issue is not the individual, but really it's the environment and the attitudes around the person. So we've had that massive change. We just need to build on it. When you trace that history along the way from rehab charity to socio-political, you see that every time we had a war and lots of vets come home with disabilities, more vets each time because the medical technology has gotten such better that more of them survive, it impacts disability policy in pretty profound ways. And while I say this and I'm keeping it as a disability issue, and I don't think we'll get where we need to be until we get it out of being a disability issue, I'm intrigued to see where we'll go next from that standpoint. So I think it's like Jeremy and Molly say, we will need to keep chipping away at it. Even a local, you know, a local level example like Lee just gave, or the curb cut example that you gave, are just, that's one place to start. Little changes at a time and working towards the bigger.
Okay. Lee, any comments there?
I'm good.
Okay.
Jeremy.
Well, I just want to thank you for this great conversation. And I just think it's so vital. And it's great to be able to talk with other people who not only have an interest, but who are thinking about these things. So just want to thank you all for including us in it, and let's do it again.
Okay.
Okay, love to. Nice to hear your voices.
I'd like to have the next show on Molly's exercise platform, though.
Okay.
All of us curled up on the pillows there.
Yeah. They call it the pod.
Yeah.
The pod.
Let's go to the pod.
The pod is wonderful.
You have to come on down, Jim.
You got it.
All right. Well, thank you, Molly and Jeremy Hale from Palo Alto Menlo Park, Jim Beck from right here in Alaska, Lee Hendrickson also from Alaska, and I'm Mike Molesky, and we'll be back again to deal with this, the extension of this topic of universal design.